Hello and welcome to season 3 of ADHD Mums. Today we kick off with a mini series that has been the most requested, and that is a school mini series. And of course, I have brought in one of our most popular guests, Millie Carr. How are you, Millie?
Hey, good. Thanks, Jane. I'm so glad to be back here.
Now, Millie has had a baby and she has come back around. I thought I'd never hear from her again. Did you tell me that you started a uni degree at the same time as you got pregnant and then you've had a baby and you're still trying to complete it?
Yeah. I'm still in the middle of it. So I started my master's in inclusive education last year. I got a scholarship through the Department of Education and I started it while pregnant and I am still doing it right now. So I have uni on Saturday. So still doing it with a 3.5 month old.
You are a busy lady. Now, if anyone has not heard of Millie, I'm going to put in the show notes her other two episodes. There are two that I'll obviously put in the show notes that are probably still, I reckon, top 5 most downloaded. I think one of them I had PMS and we really went for it. That is all in the show notes. It was a good time to go.
We did.
So Millie is, I'm going to let you introduce yourself. Millie, with who you are, what is your neurodivergent background? Do you have kids? That kind of thing.
Yep. So I am a teacher currently in leadership position at my school and also a parent to 4 children, 3 of which are neurodivergent. I'm neurodivergent myself, a late diagnosed ADHDer, potentially autistic as well. But that's something that I know you've talked about, Jane, in your other episodes as well as being very common. And I'm going to go down that route myself. But I am really passionate about education and teaching students. I've kind of got a bit of my foot in both kind of areas. So I'm a parent and I'm able to advocate and understand what it feels like to be from a parent's perspective. But I'm also a teacher and I understand what it's like to be in the classroom and how hard it is at the moment and how relentless the system is. And it's just really not helping and supporting teachers. And at the same time, if teachers are not really in a good place, that's happening and not really doing very well for our students and our parents. And it's a whole big system kind of thing that needs to happen. So I'm currently advocating and really working hard on a few different things in the background. I've written a book previously for children about masking. I've got a few other book ideas in my mind, but I've moved into a bit more of the education space and thinking of making some courses and doing some consulting work with schools and stuff as well. That's where I'm heading at the moment.
Awesome. If you would like to check out Millie Carr, I'm going to put her in the show notes. She's got some great books on about disclosing diagnosis to a child. I use one of her books myself, and we also have an episode about disclosing diagnosis to a child, which really changed the trajectory of my parenting. So that's excellent as well. So first off, I'm glad you mentioned about the teachers, because I don't think there's any parent I've met that has not believed that the teachers are doing the best job they can. There is an education system issue, which we will go into, which we believe. But this is, I haven't met a teacher that hasn't been trying their best within the system yet. So it's set up to fail for the kids and the teachers and for everybody in the system. So when we're talking about the teachers, I think we are very well aware that they don't have the resources that they need to actually probably do the things that they want to do.
Spot on, Jane. That's exactly the problem that's happening at the moment. And teachers honestly just don't know. Most of the time they just don't know. They haven't got the sufficient training either at their graduate course at uni or even throughout their career. Some schools are aware of things more than others, and you've got disparity across the entire country, really. So it depends on what postcode you live in, or potentially what kind of environment you're going to have for your child, which is not good enough.
Oh, so let's jump straight into the first episode's theme, and that is school trauma. So there is so many women within this podcast, which is why it was so heavily requested, that are feeling really, God, there's so many feelings that go along with schooling. Frustration might be a big one, anger, disappointment. So when we talk about school trauma, what does this actually look like? And we obviously know that some kids will act out, but some kids won't. What does it really look like when children are starting to show signs of trauma?
Yeah, look, the thing is, you've got students in the classroom that are visibly, or not visibly, that's the problem. They're masking what's going on. So a lot of the time students are, there's always unwritten rules that happen in education that students don't know unless they're neurotypical. A lot of neurotypical students pick those things up. Neurodivergent students don't pick those things up, things like social cues and rules that are not really spoken about and they're just meant to be there. So what's happening is that they are literally trying to copy and mask or hide or suppress sensory urges, things that they need to be doing or don't understand. And the suppression of that all day, holding that in, making sure that they're trying to look at the teacher. The whole body listening thing is like a massive issue that is still going around, which I'm just baffled by. Students are concentrating so much on this all the time that they can't possibly be able to listen and learn. So they're going home, and the trauma from not feeling understood, not feeling like people understand them and feel like they belong in the classroom either, they can tell they're different. And they can tell that it's not working for them and they don't know why and what the difference is. So what's happening is they're going home, and then that's where you parents are always seeing the different behaviour sometimes at home, especially for those students that don't visibly are explosive or anything at school, which obviously happens at school, and there's trauma related to that too. Then you've got the students that are pleasing, people pleasers, and that are just trying to copy and mask. They go home and all of that explosion stuff happens at home instead of at school, because they're holding it all in real tight, kind of like a giant big like compression, holding a lid on like a shaken Diet Coke bottle, and then whoosh, everything happens at home. But then you've got the students that fight. So they're the kids that go home and fawn and they please. Then there's the kids that fight at school. And the trauma related to that is they just feel like they are naughty, they are bad, they are not good students, they're never going to learn. Other students start to leave them as outcasts because they're not fitting in and they're not being normal. So you've got this situation where students are just feeling like, yeah, the essence of it is not belonging and not feeling like they fit in and not feeling like they deserve to be there and like someone understands them. And that's going to send students to have massive trauma. And it follows, doesn't always come out straight away either. It's like ongoing. Sometimes this kind of stuff goes around in circles, and the more that they neglected their needs, the more trauma that we get. And then we see this stuff happen later and later in life. And I can attest to that myself personally, that I didn't think that I had trauma from school. When I was going through it, I was one of those ones that people pleased and made sure that I was doing everything correct, star student. But it's definitely affected me. And I don't even know when I first got diagnosed who I actually really was. Is this the masking, Millie? Is that like me just putting on a show, or who actually am I? And it's an identity kind of crisis for them.
Yeah. And then season one, I interviewed so many women who were late diagnosed who were doing exactly what you're saying, suppressing, masking. They didn't know who they were. They had sometimes really long mental health battles for long periods of time, didn't know what was wrong with them. And it all centered around that start. And school is such a huge part of these kids' lives because they spent so many hours there. What about chronic invalidation? I reckon that's a really big one that people don't necessarily see or think about. How do you think chronic invalidation, even subtly, would impact neurodivergent kids' mental health long term?
Yeah, this is something that I see a lot. And this is something that teachers just aren't aware a lot of the time of what they're looking for. So a lot of the time, and I made a bit of a post about this last week, about teachers saying these students are fine. Oh, she's so fine. She's absolutely fabulous. She is the best student. She does all these fabulous, fantastic things. Then we'll in the same breath mention, oh, I sometimes have to like remind her to do something, or tell her to go pack up her bag because she's forgotten. So they're mentioning these little tiny signs that they're not really seeing, but then saying, they're so fabulous. They're such a good girl. They're so wonderful. Good girl or boy, because obviously it can happen with both. With girls, the presentation is slightly more common to be like this, but something like that can cause, again, it's back to that identity of being invalidated constantly. Maybe I'm actually not good. And they know deep down they're masking, they're putting it on. So they're thinking, well, I'm actually not a good girl unless I do these things. I'm actually not a good boy unless I behave in this certain way or act this certain way or follow these certain social rules that I need to, or hold everything in until I go home. So constantly invalidating students is causing them anxiety and depression and completely making them question their reality. They're completely not sure about, am I actually doing this or am I not? And then you've got the parents that are constantly getting invalidated as well. And this is not deliberately and it's not maliciously by most teachers, but they are trying to say positive, lovely things about their student. And they believe it because they don't actually know that the underlying things that are kind of there and how damaging it is. And the parents are seeing different things at home and it being invalidated as well, because they're going, that's not what I'm seeing here at home. And that's what you're seeing here at school. And the worst thing you can do as a teacher is to go, oh, I don't see that here, so it mustn't be an issue. I think if you're a teacher and you need to validate parents' experiences and say, I'm not seeing that as much here, but let's dig deeper into why that might be happening. And is something happening here at school that could be causing what you're seeing, which is different to what I'm seeing? Something like that and the validation of, okay, maybe there is something else here and maybe we need to put some strategies in place, can make a massive difference to, again, how you feel in your identity and your belonging and just feeling like people care about you and actually know you.
Oh, I agree. And I think a really common experience would be, and I'm just going to use traditional male and female roles for a second in a marriage, but it can be male-male, female-female, or single parent. But so let's say you have a mother that says, my daughter, and I reckon it'd be mainly girls, but can be boys, as you said, my daughter, I think, needs to be assessed for ADHD or whatever it is that's going on, the meltdowns at home. Yes. Teacher says, I don't see it. Okay. Let's say the mum goes, oh, okay, I'll have to do a parenting course or that's recommended to her or whatever it is, right? She goes away and does that. Let's say the partner says, oh, I don't think there's anything wrong with her. There's too many labels these days, blah, blah, blah. The mother eventually gets to the pediatrician. I reckon she's about $600 in at this point just to get there, pays for the appointment before she walks in, the $600, to then have the teacher report pulled out and says they don't see anything there. And then the child is turned away. The mother ticks it off the list. Oh, that's not it because the pediatrician said. And then that's it. Because why would you go back and check? You just don't have the money and the time. And that's where I reckon all these late diagnosed women are going to be coming through still. From this centered around the fact that no one can pick up when a child is actually not doing that well at school.
We wait until it's like all going bad. Mm-hmm. We know it was like there's little tiny mini signs that are happening constantly. Like even a teacher saying, oh, she's really fine, but I have to help her do this. Or all of these little mini signs that teachers are missing. And again, it's not through any malicious fault. They really just don't know. And I myself personally, I had a student that I taught in grade four and she was literally a star student. She had got all awards up until the point she was in my classroom. And at that point, I wasn't aware that I had ADHD. I was only really familiar with the stereotypical presentation as well. And I did the same thing to her. I did the exact same thing. I never flagged it with her mum. And then she got to grade six and I was by then in a leadership position working with her cohort again, working with her, and everything fell apart for her. It fell apart. She told me, so she barely would speak to a teacher about anything. She was someone who always did really well in her learning. Her learning started to completely, she was not really finishing her work. She wasn't doing it to the standard that she was doing. She was going home and being really reserved and in her bedroom doing projects and stuff at home, but not coming out and speaking to her family. She said to me when she let her friends know, her friends came and told me, Millie, we're really concerned about this student. And this is what she's been saying. And there was what she was saying. She was at a point in grade six, might I add, she was 12. She was talking about self-harm and not feeling very good in her mind. So it got to a point where she was that bad and she was saying, I just don't have joy. There's no joy anymore. She'd been doing this for so long and she'd been getting this like this story and narrative that she'd been fabulous and she's amazing. And she kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And it got to grade six and it was breaking point. Absolutely breaking point for her in grade six. We had to send her home, get her seen by a psychologist pretty much that week because we were concerned. So all of that, that's an example of what can happen if we're not picking this stuff up. My example for myself wasn't like that, but for her, that's an extreme example of something that I would never have imagined when I taught her in grade four because I didn't know the signs and the traits and the things to look out for.
Oh, I think that's a powerful story. I actually got goosebumps. What do you think that would be? Burnout, just complete burnout from masking and trying to keep up, being this perfect child. Then eventually she was like, I just feel exhausted and burnout and there's no joy. Do you think that's what it was?
Yeah, definitely. You could tell that she was just like, she just reached a point where it was just, it's not enough. And the trauma that's going to come with that and carry on though, because she's still working on it now. Like I know she's in year eight now. I'm still aware of her and still go and check in with her. And she's getting help now, but she's still got this story in her head that she has to be perfect. She has to do things correct. She has to do, and at home, she's told the same story too. So she's getting it from everywhere. And the trauma of that has really impacted. And she's now, she's really picking up the pieces of all of this. And it's so much easier to not let it get to this point than all of a sudden intervene at this point, because the damage is already done at this point. And we're going to have to do a lot to try and help make her feel that she can be herself and belong again. So it's just something that, that kind of invalidation of people's feelings and not letting,
I wish getting a diagnosis and seeing a psychologist one time would be the end. would be like, that's it, job done, you're all fixed. If only a lot of us have battled for years and years, and that's the reality of what a lot of neurodivergent children and people are going to do, which is awful. What about, one thing I'm interested to think about is how we unpack rejection sensitivity dysphoria and then school, because I reckon that has got a lot stronger. People, women talk about chat groups, mum groups, and how they feel that. But I wonder if people really think about how children feel with RSD at school.
Oh, at school, it is a perfect environment for rejection sensitivity disorder, like a perfect environment. There are so many times throughout the school day that you can come into contact with rejection or perceived rejection, because as we know, it's not always exactly proper rejection. It could be even just they're perceived that it's rejection. Social situations, being outside, going and talking to somebody, the tone that they're using, following the rules, making sure they get a really good mark on something or answering a question correctly, or if I put my hand up, am I going to get laughed at? There are so many times during a school day that this can come up, and this can be a silent thing that you're not aware that's actually triggering other things when they go home. So they're going throughout their whole day monitoring these potential perceived rejections or actually having rejection, and they get home and that's all built up, because we know that RSD is massive for ADHDers and neurodivergent people. It hits us. We've got a sensitive kind of nervous system and it hits us a little bit harder. So the school environment is something that you can come into it all the time, and we as teachers need to be aware of that. We need to be aware of how we can limit that for students, all students, okay, so that we can make sure that even the ones that we're not quite sure there is a diagnosis, that we're making sure that we're accommodating and making it a really inclusive space, because it doesn't need to be just for specific students that we do this either. But that's something that we need to definitely take into consideration when we're teaching.
Yeah, I think so too. So why do you think some neurodivergent children internalize all the trauma and then some people please and then the other ones rebel? Like, why do you think that happens?
Research shows that kids can take one of a few different paths when they're faced with trauma and faced with nervous system overload. So you can either go, there's the four different ones. You've got the fight, flight, then you've got fawn as well. And the fawn and the fight are the ones that you see the most with neurodivergent students at school. They're the two that kind of are most reported for neurodivergent students. The fawn response, like I was speaking about a little bit earlier, the fawn response is when you're people pleasing and you're complying to whatever social rules and things that are happening at school. You follow the rules, you do the right thing, you people please, you might go out of your way to make sure that you're actually fitting in and changing yourself to fit this environment. And then you've got the fight response. And the fight response is when we're looking at students that are unable to comply to the norms and the rules, and they just feel like they have to fight against every instruction or rule. And they're the kids that you see yelling back, maybe throwing something, getting into fights, being aggressive, all of those kind of things you will see when you've got a kind of fight response. And you might take these two responses, depends on how you've been brought up, the trauma that you've already experienced at school. It might depend on your nervous system itself and your natural lean towards those different things. So they're the two kind of responses that we generally see. And what I have found is that the fight response is the most visible. That's the one that we see all the time. That's the one that we're intervening, we're putting behavior plans in, we're sending kids home, expelling them. They're the kids that are, you can visibly see it. And then you've got the fawn response. They're the ones that are going completely almost unnoticed, because they're able to hide it that well that they're actually making it appear that nothing is wrong. They're the ones that you actually really have to look out for. If you've got a student that is overly people-pleasing and overly high-achieving, I've started to dig a little bit deeper with those kids, because they're the ones that I'm like, why are they doing this? Why are they needing my approval and all of that so much? And that's the response that normally is happening. And it's due to our nervous system cannot, it's very sensitive for neurodivergence, and it just cannot take on all these different sensory, cognitive load type stuff that's happening. And executive functioning, we're focusing on so much stuff. So these are the responses that kind of we use. It's a survival mechanism. We're surviving. They're just surviving.
I do wonder with the schooling system and the huge amounts of demands that we now place on kids. And we've got, as you said, we've got the kids that do stand out because they fight. And they're the ones that I feel like the parents still, I still hear, I heard this the other day, where someone said, oh, I think that kid has ADHD or something, and then talked about or how he had this awful behaviour. And I was just listening, going, oh my God, I just can't deal with this. But What I wonder is, though, when you're talking about those high achieving kids, I would wonder whether exactly what you were saying, are they actually neurotypical? Because it's like all the high achieving ones, how are they coping with all of that stuff? Neurotypical people, I don't think, generally have that much drive. They just don't work at the same level that we work at. And so you're completely right. For a child to be completely successful at school, be that kid, are they really neurotypical? Because I would argue that they're not.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you, Jane. It's like, I know my partner, he's neurotypical and he just doesn't care about everything as much. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's very much like, he's like, oh, I'm happy to do this. I'm happy to do that. And he takes things as he comes. And I've seen students like this too. They will try hard and they work towards a goal, but they're not killing themselves. They're not pushing themselves to the point where they are literally staying up late doing something. And that's something that I do. I know that's something that I lean towards, the overachieving, do all the things and juggle all the plates. And they're the kids that we need to really pick up, because they're the ones that probably, that's not a response that's neurotypical generally. If they're doing all that stuff, I'd be digging a bit deeper and trying to figure out why. And also, because the behavior, there's always a reason behind behavior. And that's a behavior that people praise people for that though. We still as adults praise people. We praise people for overdoing it and doing too much. And oh my God, it's amazing how much you can do. But it's not actually really sustainable and it leads to burnout. And then people go around in cycles and cycles of this. And we need to help them not get to adulthood where they're going around and around and everything falls apart when they have kids, like it has happened, did for me or for other parents that I know listen to your podcast, Jane.
Oh, I agree. And I think if you have a child, particularly that's autistic, and you have the messages around, do your best. I just want you to do your best. I just want you to do your best. Okay. They're going to do their best every single minute of every single day forever. That is a lot of toll. If you think about doing your best, your absolute best every single day, that's actually impossible. But that's the standard that I think school doesn't mean to necessarily, but puts on kids. And then you've got the literal thinkers who are quite capable and they literally kill themselves for this thing that doesn't matter. Not that I say it doesn't matter, but on the scheme of things.
It's not worth killing yourself for, is it though? But it's an unwritten rule. When they say at school, give your best, neurodivergents take it so literally, like do your best. And I have had this conversation with my partner about how, because I do my best for me means 110%. If I'm doing my best, I'm like, I have no minute to spare. I've got to make sure I use every minute to like actually put into this. If I've given 80%, that's not my best. Whereas my partner sees 80% as his best because that was his best on that day. That was his capacity and that was his best on the day. So we've got to remember that when we're saying this to kids, we want people to strive and we want to push them because we know we want to make sure students like reach their potential, but you've got to be very careful with neurodivergent students. We've got to be very careful because that's one of those rules and unwritten things that we just assume students understand what that means, but they actually go, oh, that means 110%. I have to actually literally nearly kill myself to get this done. And it's not sustainable. You do that every single task that you're doing at school. No wonder students are getting to a point where they're just like, I hate school. I hate school.
Yeah, because it's too hard. Because
it's too hard.
Internal pressure. Last question, because we're going to try and keep these episodes to 30. Good luck to us. As to school trauma, what role do you think power imbalances in school play? So teacher, student, school parent. Like, how do you think you can shape trust to actually keep an eye on this and keep the open communication around mental health with the power imbalances?
I think a lot of the time schools take a bit of an authoritative approach. Not, again, I don't think any school or teacher generally do this deliberately, but it's like if you don't follow the rules, there's no gray area with some of these things. And I think we need to take each case, you know, it's case by case. And based on students, and the first and foremost important part in trust is obviously the relationship that you've got between the school. I know that's something that you've spoken about a lot, Jane, you know, how important it is to have parents and teachers and schools on the same page and understanding each other and having a positive regard for each other. Do you mean like parents not coming into the conversation assuming that the teacher's not capable or not caring about their child? And vice versa, students coming in, not assuming that teachers are coming in and not assuming that at home parents are doing something that's causing whatever is happening at school. Because that's obviously the rhetoric that sometimes happens. Parents are hearing, oh, it must be something that you're doing. It's the only reason why you're seeing here at home and not at school. So I think in order to build trust and to have those, the power imbalance, we need to be all on the same page and forget that I'm the teacher, I'm the leader, and you're the parent. We're all together on this learning journey of how to learn about this student. How do we learn about our child in this student? Because every student's different and no one student's going to be exactly the same as the next one. So we have to come at this together. That's why we have IEP meetings and talk about stuff, and we have different people coming together to do these things so that we're all on the same page and we take away that I'm the person that knows the most, because that's not always the case, especially for some schools that haven't gone through training in neurodivergence. Some schools don't actually know more than the parent. Sometimes the parent has got a wealth of knowledge. And what I love is I've got my son actually goes to a special education school and he requires some extra assistance. And the teacher didn't know I was a teacher. And when I came in, he was telling me all of the goals and I was a little bit concerned about some of the goals. I spoke about some of the strategies that I had. And instead of just saying, no, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to do what I think because I'm the teacher in this scenario, he went back and learned a little bit with messaging me and saying, oh, look, we've tried this thing that you said, look how this is working, and then give me a photo. And I think it's like trusting the relationship and each side trying different things so that we can make sure that, yeah, the student is actually thriving, because at the end of the day, that's all we both want. Hopefully, that's all they both want.
I love this. So, Millie, let's say we have some listeners who have children who they believe are experiencing school trauma or have experienced it. What would be a couple of takeaways for them that they could get from this episode?
Yeah, I really think it's really important. If you're seeing something at home and they're not seeing it and it's not being seen at school, I think the first thing to do is to make sure that you contact your teacher. So start with the teacher and talk about the things that you're seeing and what they're seeing and maybe potential reasons why that's happening. So some of the reasons it could be, and you could say this to the teacher, it could be that they're overloaded with information. It could be that they're trying to be perfect all day. It could be a social issue. And together, try and dig down to the actual root of the problem, because there's definitely probably a reason that's happening at school. If that doesn't work with the teacher, I always recommend having someone in leadership contacting them as well. So not over the teacher, you contact the teacher first, but I would ask, if you have a meeting of any sort, is to always have a leadership person with you as well. And the thing that kind of helps, that often a leadership person has a little bit more training or a little bit awareness than potentially the teacher that you've got. It also helps to have someone take some notes and have like he said, she said type situation, because you're not crazy. You're not going crazy. If you're seeing like massive meltdowns at home, if they're shutting down, if they don't have any joy, if they don't want to come out and talk to you, if all of these things are happening, then, you know, you're not crazy. And bringing it to them and actually trying to change a few things during their day to see if that helps at home, that's going to be massive for them. So you don't have to have a diagnosis to do this either. They don't need to have a diagnosis to go in and say, look, this is what I'm seeing. What do you think? Can we put a few things in and see if that helps a little bit and helps me? So that when they come home, they're not so, so overloaded. And then that in turn is going to help if we can tackle some of these things while you're seeing it at the very first signs of seeing it, rather than getting to a point where they're in high school or an adult. That's going to help mitigate some of the trauma that they're going to have and hold on to, I think, for the rest of their life.
Oh, I love that answer. And if you're listening and you're thinking to yourself, that sounds great, but my school isn't a school that will do that, or I've tried that before, it hasn't worked. Don't worry, we are going to, in this mini series, go into what happens if you don't have a school that's on board with you. So it would be great if every school was like that. Unfortunately, they aren't, but that's okay, because we're going to get to that later on. Thank you so much for your time, Millie. I absolutely love this episode. I think we've done well to get it done in 30 minutes. Well done.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jane.
Excellent. We will see you next week and we will continue the mini series. Thank you very much.
See you later, Jane.